Hello again and welcome to I've Got a Beatles Podcast. And today it's Dave coming at you with an interview. And I'm very pleased to welcome William Eckhard to the program. William is an associate professor of music at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. And he's the author of Neil Young and the Poetics of Energy. But for our purposes, for our Beatle podcast today, we're going to talk about his 2017 book called Psychedelic Popular Music, A History Through Musical Topic Theory. And I will post the link to Indiana University Press here so you can take a look at the information about the book. But as soon as I saw the cover, it was a very attractive kind of psychedelic trippy cover.
Yeah.
And then I looked at the book and I thought, well, there's the Beatles and there's the Grateful Dead and all these great groups. So welcome to the program, William.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Well,
I was happy with the cover. The press did a nice job on that, I thought.
Oh yeah, it's very when you're walking around academic conferences and you see kind of the same old dull types of covers, this one really stands out on the bookseller. So, well, I'm curious. So you've written just to talk a little bit about you before we get into the book. What's your own background? Because you're writing about Neil Young and pop music. So are you?
Sure.
Yeah. What's your background?
It's pretty mixed up. I mean, when I was growing up, I took piano lessons, like classical piano, and went to a lot of classical concerts. So I was very plugged into the sort of the art music tradition. But I was also growing up, you know, in Toronto in the 80s. So, you know, I was also very attracted, obviously, to popular culture, and I listened to a lot of rock music. At that time, a lot of prog rock, a lot of industrial kinds of things. And then academically, I did an undergrad in theory and composition. So that kind of continued with, you know, my engagement with musical practice and the theoretical end of things. But then for my graduate work, I went into ethnomusicology because I was also very interested in culture and the way that music is meaningful to people and what they use it for, why they care about it. And I was lucky because the program I went to at York University was also very strong in popular music studies. So it was one of the only places in Canada at that time where you could effectively do a degree in popular music studies. It was called ethnomusicology, and it was a very, very culturally based approach to popular music studies. But so I did some work on Stomp and Tom Connors, who's a Canadian country musician, and then the work on Neil Young was after that. So, you know, my background is very, very mixed. A lot of actual, from a young age, being involved in rock music, but also being involved in classical music. And so I've always tried to keep those two talking to each other in one way or another.
And I think that's so when you're talking about the Beatles, that's a constant thing, because as you mentioned, as we always talk about with the Beatles, with George Martin, certainly we're exposed to classical, to both traditions and both the types of music constantly.
Oh yeah, very, very much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Beatles are one of the first bands to be, you know, really accepted, because, you know, back when they were, you know, happening in the 60s and early 70s, it was more unusual for those two worlds to cross over, you know. Mm-hmm. So they were one of the very early places where you see people, rock people, getting more interested in classical music through that, and also vice versa. A lot of, you know, it's still the case where the Beatles are one of the bands that, you know, if there's somebody who's heavily in classical music culture, if they're into one or two rock bands, chances are one of them's the Beatles, right?
Yeah, so. But they're okay for kind of the general public or general consumption for everybody, it seems. That, yeah.
There's still a bit of a bridge, so that's nice.
Yeah, exactly. What instrument do you play? Are you a guitar player? Or just imagining a guitarist?
Yeah. No, that's complicated, too. Yeah, I've got they can't see it, but I got the flannel on.
Yeah, you look like a guitar player, so...
Well, it's funny. I mean, when I was growing up, I did classical, like piano to piano. And in terms of keyboards, I was very, very into Pink Floyd, you know, the electronic space rock stuff. So also synthesizers and keyboards in general. But yeah, I also played a lot of guitar. And as undergrad, I started as a piano major and I switched to classical guitar halfway through. So I ping-ponged.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And lately, it's funny. I mean, just about a year ago, I made a decision. It's like, okay, back to keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, life got busy. I've always done both, but it was harder and harder to be good at both.
Yeah.
So lately I haven't been playing guitar for a few years, but it's always going to be there. I'll probably come back to it.
Oh yeah. And I imagine it's really useful, as my own stuff writing about the Beatles, to be able to just either a keyboard or a guitar, just to sit down and play the songs.
Yeah.
Really helps.
I did a lot. especially with the transcriptions, it was really useful to have a certain amount of facility on both, because, you know, because, yeah, playing it is a big part of transcribing for sure.
Exactly. So as we get into this, so psychedelic is a term that gets bandied about a lot, and it's got a lot of threads and different definitions, and you obviously, for a book titled Psychedelic Popular Music, you have to have a pretty good definition or definitions of what you mean by psychedelic music. So what, how do you define it? Is it just drugs? Is it just, you know, long hair?
You know, I mean, like I was saying, since I come, a lot of my training is cultural theory and ethnomusicology and anthropology, things like that. I like to start not with a fixed definition, but just look at what is the word meant to people? How have people used the word? You know, so the first thing I did was I spent a few months just tracking all the stuff that had been called psychedelic, you know, by in print mostly, but also in my experience having known a lot of people in music, and then trying to figure out, okay, well, what are the reasons? Because not every, you know, the word gets used in a lot of different ways. I think it can mean different things at different times. And what I ended up boiling it down to was sort of three major things that I was seeing. One is, you know, sometimes it is very connected to the drugs and to experience, you know, and so there's this idea that a lot of times it's about intention, especially if you look, you know, in the 1950s, before the 60s, before there was psychedelic music, there were still people exploring psychedelic drugs and that sort of thing, and finding that they tended to prefer certain kinds of music, certain kinds of art. So there was already this kind of feeling that certain kinds of music and literature and art worked with that sort of experience. And so, you know, it's one thing it's about is intention. If somebody perceives a certain kind of art or music as being related to the psychedelic experience, then for them that is psychedelic, right? Similarly about, you know, if the music is made with an intention, we're going to make something that's going to, you know, fit this experience. Right. So the intention is one thing. It could be psychedelic intent, I called it in the book.
And I'm curious, do you know the first use of that term related to music?
let's pause for a second. One thing that I chose to do is I had my psychedelic timeline. When I was writing the book, this was a really useful thing. So, yeah, I've got a rough sense. It was, I mean, the first use of the word psychedelic, 1956. I've got a note. The term psychedelic is coined in a letter to Huxley by Humphrey Osmond. Humphrey Osmond was a doctor who Huxley was for collaborating with at that time. So the first use of the word psychedelic that I found on record is 1956.
Wow. So that's, most people, I don't think, would know that. They would say, oh, it only happened at the Summer of Love, or it's 1966, something.
Yeah. And one thing that's interesting is, you know, it started as people think of it as this big popular culture explosion thing, like rock music and love-ins and all that stuff, which was, you know, the mid to late 60s, 66, 67. Some very hip people in 1965. but really, you know, it was the whole post-war period. But it was an elite thing then, right? It was psychedelic research at places like Harvard, you know.
Like Timothy Leary and people like
Timothy
that.
Timothy Leary, but also even much more reputable psychologists. And in the late 50s, there was this huge boom with the sort of the Hollywood elite, like really famous actors and writers and painters. Psychedelic therapy was a big deal by the late 50s.
Didn't Cary Grant do something?
Right. People like that, right? And so it was actually an interesting change when it moved into popular culture and became a mass thing. And you could argue that one reason it became illegal and became perceived as such a social problem was when the lid came off it in that way, right? You know, when it was a bunch of more privileged, more connected people experimenting, you know, it was sort of tolerated, but then when it became this mass movement. So, okay, so one thing is, you know, forms of art, including music, that are sort of used or created with this intention that they should be experienced psychedelically, right? The other big thing about it, though, is that what happens is that turns into a style. You know, over time, as more and more and more people, for example, decide Indian music, Hindustani classical music is going to be the thing that works for them with this. And then you get rock musicians picking that up, you get ragga rock. And eventually it becomes this stylistic association where even when people don't have the intent, let's say somebody isn't involved in psychedelic drugs or psychedelic culture, but they want to signify that for some reason. They know I can use a sitar, I can use a certain kind of vocal sound, you know,
yes,
into the microphone, use a lot of echo. And so that's interesting because there, you know, the intention is part of it in a lot of cases, but not always. Sometimes it's just a style. And you get people who are not involved in psychedelic drugs or experience at all, but you still make psychedelic music in that sense, right? So for me, those were the two big things. There was the sense that there is this intent and this subculture that are involved in a certain kind of activity. But then over time, that turns into a style and a bunch of more conventional signifiers that get separated from that intention and that activity and have their own set of meanings.
Well, that's a great segue to the second part of your title, talking about a history of through musical topic theory. And so you mentioned a couple of good words that are often used with topic theory, like signifiers and styles, things like that, tropes. For those who aren't familiar with topic theory, it's, at least from my field in music theory, we've used it in different ways for a lot of classical music, for talking about going back to 1980, I think, was Leonard Ratner's book on classic music.
Yeah, that's right.
That was kind of the first big thing I remember. And it's been a popular way to talk about music, but it's not been applied to this type of music very much. So what is topic theory and how can it apply? And is it going to scare everybody listening? It's really complicated.
Right.
And you have to have a PhD.
Should be afraid.
Yes.
No. Okay. I'll do the short version as much as I can. I mean, the first thing is to understand is that it's part of the study of musical signs in general, right? So what's a sign? A sign is like a word or a traffic sign. It's anything which is, you know, functions to mean something else, to stand for something else, to bring a certain idea to mind. So, you know, there's all sorts of signs. I mean, fashion can be a sign. You dress a certain way because you want to send a certain message about your identity, or you want to belong in a certain group, so you cut your hair a certain way. Words are an obvious example. Every word, the meaning of the word is something different from the sound of the word. You know, there's this cultural connection that's made so that the word bird brings to mind a certain kind of animal. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's this very general thing of signs, meaningful units of culture. Right. And music obviously has signs in it because music is meaningful to people. You know, I mean, people don't, when they hear music, they don't just hear abstract sound. They hear ideas, they hear feelings, they might be reminded of times and places. You know, it's very evocative. So there's the broad study of, well, how then does music create these meanings? Right. And so topic theory is a more narrow part of that, is looking at one particular kind of musical sign, you know, the musical topic. As I was telling you earlier, when we were talking before the podcast, my book on Neil Young is concerned more with really abstract musical signs. How does it feel?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the energetic? Is it, you know, what's the energetic shape of it? What are the metaphors, the more abstract stuff? But music also can raise very specific meanings, right? I mean, like if you hear a waltz, let's say it's like a Viennese, like a Strauss kind of waltz,
mm-hmm.
you know, you immediately think of Vienna, you think of a certain, you might picture a ballroom, people dancing in formal evening wear.
Mm-hmm. 19th century elegant hall.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, you just hear a little bit of that music, like a very little bit, right?
Yeah.
You know, bum, 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 ba-dum, bum, 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 bum.
Mm-hmm.
And you're there. It evokes it, right? That's one example of a topic. You know, another one from popular music is if you hear that Chuck Berry.
Oh, yeah, but, classic riff in the 1950s, right?
You see the milkshake and you see mm-hmm. the guitar and you see the kids dancing, right? So, you know, within music, there's this particular kind of sign. And those are examples of, you know, one more example is, you know, like military topics. You hear the snare drum, brum-ba-da-dum, brum-ba-da-dum, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you get this sort of marching kind of military image. And so topic theory basically is the study of how does a sound become topical in that way? You know, what happens so that you can immediately, you get this little snippet of sound and it just opens, it so strongly connects to this particular cultural world, right?
Yeah.
So one thing is just, it's like there's this technical side, how does that happen, right? That can, like you say, that can get scary. That can be really formal. Right. I mean, you have to at some point analyze the music to say, well, what specific sounds are doing this?
Mm-hmm. Like chords and melodies and
particular chords, particular, you know. And one thing of like you were saying, one thing my book is maybe trying to contribute is to apply this more to popular music than has been done before. And in that, you also have to talk about things like not just melodies and chords and rhythms, like the familiar music theory stuff, but also sound, right? I mean, particular kinds of echo.
Yeah, the actual production side of things.
You know, reverb is really interesting. Echo and reverb are interesting because, I mean, one kind of reverberation and echo, it's Sun Studios in the 50s, Elvis, it's rockabilly. The slapback echo thing, right? Another kind of echo is a cathedral.
Yeah.
And that's topical because as soon as you hear that cathedral echo, you picture the cathedral, you picture a certain cultural space, right? So, you know, that's one part of topic theory is this very technical, what specific sounds are involved, right? But it's also historical because what those sounds mean to people is usually rooted in history, rooted in sociology and culture. You know, so why did this sound become Chuck Berry? Why did this sound become the cathedral and Gregorian chant? You know, so for people who relate less to the music theory side, there's also that whole interesting cultural history side. You know, like how does the music's history develop in such a way that these sounds develop these particular meanings?
I know we'll get into it a little bit later, but nostalgia is something I always think of. That's a really powerful, powerful emotion, powerful memory jogging thing, and what sounds in. Especially the Beatles, there's a ton of. They were very concerned with nostalgia, especially at this time, which I know is something that I think John Lennon talked about. LSD made him more interested in kind of his past and looking at himself and historically. That's a big part of it.
Oh yeah, well I mean that makes the Beatles especially significant topically because one thing about a topic is that, you know, the topic gets its meaning because it's really in a particular time and place, right? I mean, the Chuck Berry thing means it because Chuck Berry actually at certain times in the 50s used that sound, right? The military snare drum means the military because it was actually happening in military parades and military drills and things. But for it to become a topic, it's got to be separated from that. Like, it isn't just part of this anymore. It means this. You know, it's about the military rather than being in the military. Like we said earlier, music, psychedelia as a style is about psychedelic experience. It isn't psychedelic experience in itself, right? So nostalgia is part of it because the topic is about separation. It's about distance. You have the topic because you're not connected to the original thing, you know?
Yeah.
We're not in the 19th century waltzing in Vienna anymore. And that's why we have a topic for it because the topic, and so, you know, that sense of distance or loss or separation is always part of a topic. It's built into the structure.
That's fascinating, and I think it leads well that the next couple of questions I want to put together in a way, because what makes, you've already alluded to this a little bit, but to you, what makes pop music psychedelic? And I think it would have to be musical traits probably as well as the extra musical traits, kind of a mixture of both things. So what, like I said, it's not just taking LSD and then sitting listening to music. I mean, there's certain signifiers and things that happen.
Well, I mean, at that point, we're talking about pop psychedelic music as a style, right?
As a style.
What are the style traits? There's a bunch. I mean, some of the, just off the top of my head, drones are really important.
Oh, yeah.
You know, long, either no chord changes or chords that just kind of wander back and forth without this strong sense of direction. So drone-like or oscillating sorts of chords. Certain kinds of global music references, obviously certain ways of using Indian classical music. As soon as you create a hybrid between Indian classical music and rock or funk or soul or something like that, that is very often psychedelic. Certain production details, I mean, like, you know, the sort of whispering into the microphone or indistinct voices in general, you know, sort of like backwards voices. One thing that I wasn't really expecting, but I noticed a lot, especially in the earlier 60s stuff, is a mix where sounds just kind of get foregrounded and then drop back really fast, and this kind of swimming and out sort of effect in the mix. So you'll be listening, and then suddenly, for no apparent reason, one sound will just jump right to the foreground and then disappear again. you know, so that's another style trait, which is a lot of earlier psychedelic music does this kind of weird. You're never quite sure where the focus is sonically, because there's sort of things that there's no particular traditional musical reason why the guitar would suddenly get really loud, but it does.
So in a way, it's being done at the production level by the mixer or by the producer or somebody.
And this is why with like a group like the Beatles, right? It's so crucial that they have this super close relationship with George Martin.
Yeah, exactly.
And in general, you know, I mean, this was the era where popular musicians became a lot more selective and picky about who they worked with as producers and engineers. A lot of that was because, you know, in psychedelic music, a lot of these style traits have to do with production. Like we said earlier, certain kinds of echo and certain kinds of reverberation, they're not just decoration to the sound. To have the right kind of space rock sound, for example, you need the right kind of echoes and reverbs.
A lot of those things you're mentioning, like the drones and the, obviously as soon as you hear a sitar note, you immediately think of, oh, it's psychedelic, it's the Beatles, it's Rolling Stones on Paint It Black or whatever.
Yeah.
Why do you think Eastern sound and aesthetic kind of part of psychedelic music?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that when you study the history of this, like I said, you know, one part of the big part of topic theory is studying histories. And one thing you find is when a new topical field appears, I mean, you know, we would call psychedelia a topical field because there's certain topics that are very common and certain style traits that are very, really common. Of course, you know, when those are first being established, what happens is it isn't all invented brand new. A lot of times it's people just drawing upon older topics that they find especially interesting or attractive or useful, right? So yeah, in the mid-60s, you look at groups like the Kinks or the Yardbirds or the Beatles. They invented a lot of stuff, but they also repeated a lot of stuff that they found. So Paul McCartney with his interest in older music hall and Tin Pan Alley kinds of popular music. And yeah, another one that got drawn on a lot was their understanding of Indian classical music.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Now, you know, politically, one thing you have to acknowledge here is that there is all sorts of interesting politics about cultural appropriation and representation, right? Because the way they were drawing on it was, I think, very well intentioned, but there was an awful lot of stereotyping and Orientalism involved. You know, a lot of it was a fantasy of Indian classical music and Indian culture to a certain extent.
And in a way, I think at least George Harrison did study with Ravi Shankar seriously and tried to make it more than...
I was going to say, one thing that's important about the Beatles, to be fair, is that some people, like George Harrison, then, of course, did the extra step and said, okay, well, I'm interested in this. Maybe I should really go find out about it.
Yeah.
And the Beatles were obviously important for that because he was a great example of somebody who did that. So the question is why, right?
Yeah.
Why was Indian classical music? And, you know, a lot of times, when you ask why does one kind of older topic get absorbed into a new topical field, you've got to ask, I use the word cognate a lot in the book, you know, which basically by that I just mean points of agreement or points of resonance. What was it about this that made it feel appropriate to or a good fit for this new thing? So in the case of Indian classical music, obviously it has a heavy spiritual component, a heavy meditative component. I mean, a lot of traditional Indian musicians perceive music as a form of yoga. It's not just about playing the music, but it's about a spiritual practice, and the music is a vehicle for that. And that was very similar to the way a lot of these psychedelic musicians felt about their new view of music as a spiritual practice, as a psychedelic journey. You know, it's about creating a new life, not just about... So there were certain philosophical things that, you know, the hippies perceived as being, you know, similar or a good fit and resonant. You know, in a more literal sense, a lot of them were taking up yoga and taking up meditation anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it wasn't... another thing that's neat about topics is, of course, a particular topic... One way you know you're dealing with a topic and not just some other kind of sign is that it isn't just musical.
It's got the extra musical side to it as well.
Yeah, and so, I mean, there's musical Indian culture, but that connects to visual art, connects to yoga practices, to meditation,
spirituality,
all sorts of stuff. And so, I mean, one reason, if you look at the way that hippies and psychedelic people in the 60s were adopting Indian music, it was because they were interested in Indian culture overall, and that was because they were seekers. They were looking for a certain kind of change in their lifestyle, and they felt at that time that certain kinds of Indian spiritual practice in the broad sense, offered that to them, and the music came along as part of that.
And that certainly speaks a lot to how the Beatles got into this whole topic or style, because 1965 was kind of the crucial year for them. They did Help, where they heard Indian musicians. That was a big deal. And then also John and George were introduced to LSD in 65 right. by their dentist friend, and that kind of set things off from there. Their own interest, I mean, of course, you talk about Norwegian Wood as being the, you know, the first song of theirs that had Indian instrument on it, but I think most Beatle fans probably don't think of psychedelic music in the Beatles until Revolver. And especially the last song on Revolver, Tomorrow Never Knows, is really kind of the first one that just make everybody go, whoa, what's going on here? Something's different. Yeah. And so you talk about that song, and I'm curious how you view the Beatles in terms of their psychedelic journey to getting to that point.
Sure. Well, I mean, one point that I make in the book is that it's really hard with the Beatles, I think, to define a psychedelic period. I mean, there's the obvious one where they were pretty much advocating, not wholeheartedly. They weren't 13-4 elevators about it. But still, by Beatles standards, there was this period where they were kind of making no secrets of their involvement in psychedelic culture.
Yeah.
And that period extends from Revolver through Magical Mystery Tour, right?
Mm-hmm.
Although even by Magical Mystery Tour, if you looked at what was going on in their lives, there was this much heavier drift in other directions already by that point.
Yeah.
So, you know, really full flight, you're talking Revolver and Sgt. Pepper's, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you look at the stuff that makes that, if you look at psychedelia in a broader sense, you know, the whole set of interests and style traits that came to a peak in those two records, a lot of it was present earlier, right? I mean, Rubber Soul,
yeah.
In my mind, there's a lot of very psychedelic stuff
on
that record. A lot of people point to Rain as the first really fully psychedelic record.
My favorite Beatles song, as our listeners know, by the way.
It's
so
a
that's,
beautiful song.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is.
I was, to be honest, there was a number of artists I had never paid as much close attention to as I should before writing the book, and the Beatles was among them, I'll confess. And when I, you know, Rain was, you know, Rain is a little bit off of the mainstream Beatles discography. So
yeah,
when I finally got to it, it's like, wow, this is gorgeous, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It also contains almost all of the core psychedelic elements, right? And then, you know, going later, by the time you get to Help, probably, I mean, by the time you get to Let It Be, not so much, but I mean, Abbey Road is, in my mind, very psychedelic record, at least stylistically.
Ooh, interesting.
Lot of stuff. Even something like Here Comes the Sun, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's less obvious, but it's not like, you know, I hear it as more of a continuation. It's not any kind of repudiation, let's say that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so in my mind, the Beatles, one thing that makes them interesting is that although you've got this peak psychedelia period, really it's this long, because a lot of the key stuff, you know, the poetic lyrics, getting away from the simple love songs into something more exploratory,
mm-hmm.
the sonic exploration, the interest in Indian music, also the interest in avant-garde classical music and tape, you know,
right.
electronic music, all of that stuff they were already experimenting with by, you know, Rubber Soul, even a little bit on Help, certainly singles like Rain.
Yeah, and you know? Certainly on Tomorrow Never Knows, where you've got backwards loops and the drum,
yeah.
that really is kind of like that almost has everything on it too, in a way. It's got the drone, one chord, and it's very much,
well, and it's, I mean, it's funny how that tune has became such a touchstone for techno bands in the 90s and stuff too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just that boom, back, boom, 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 boom,
yeah,
everywhere.
The drum.
It was everywhere. You couldn't listen to anything in like 90 to 93 or whatever. It was just inescapable. So
see, Ringo was a trendsetter. Yeah.
Ringo is underrated, we know.
Yes,
that.
He is.
He's a very, very great drummer. So it's, you know, my interest in the Beatles is sort of to put that psychedelic stuff in a broader context, you know, to say it's, you know, how did it represent the peak of a much bigger trend?
Well, and I think most people would probably say obviously Sgt. Pepper, but if you're going to pick a song, it's Strawberry Fields Forever, because that, what's so fascinating is with the Sgt. Pepper box set that came out recently and all the other takes, hearing early takes of that song, it wasn't psychedelic at all. It was just kind of a simple folky type song, and then it just got everything put onto it. And so you do a great analysis of Strawberry Fields that lists the, you've got all the regular things like form and things like that, but you also talk about all the topics. A lot of them are instrumental. So can you give us kind of your summary of, do you think that's one of the quintessential psychedelic songs?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And that's why it was, it got so much. I mean, and as you know, if you're, when you're writing an academic piece, especially a book, you have to get brutal with your page count.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you know, I was trying in this book to like cover, because of course, you know, the 60s is part of it, right? It's like there's the 70s. I do like the sort of neo-psychedelic and then the psytrance and the electronic dance music stuff. Mm-hmm. So I had to be really, really, really strict. And I still ended up giving what, 5, 6, 7 pages just to that one song. So yeah, it was, and you know, it wasn't something that I went in with the thought, you know, a lot of this was discovered during analysis, you know, it's like I spent a whole summer transcribing a bunch of music and then months and months just sort of looking at what was there, and certain things would drift to the top. And this, that, you know, Strawberry Fields became more and more and more. It's like, wow, this really is. And you know, it's pretty much all there. Like if you were to make a list of the key, one thing that surprised me about it was, again, the sort of the Indian stuff I was feeling in there, like with the strings. That kind of glissando string stuff that comes in. Mm-hmm. Not at the beginning. The strings also do this dark orchestral horror soundtrack thing at the beginning, and then they become Indian about somewhere, you know, I don't remember exactly where, but in the middle-ish of the song. You've got this sort of electronic touches more and more as you go along. It develops into sort of a, and also free jazz almost, like jazz experimental electronic thing.
And the coda.
In the coda, I'm thinking. You have the psychedelic folk, because like you're saying, it evolved out of a folk song, and it still has that kind of feeling to it. So it isn't like the incredible string band, but it still kind of touches to that side of psychedelia, because, you know, you can still feel like on some level it's this guy singing you a song with an acoustic guitar and then all this other stuff crystallizing around it. And it has some of the very intense electric guitar stuff too. Not a lot, but just enough that you know that it's there. You know, some fairly hard-edged fuzz guitar is in there as well. So it was just remarkable, because, you know, I always thought of that song when I just knew it as a listener as fairly straightforward.
And it is formally,
Yeah, it is formally, and the idea is very clear. And it has this, you know, it has a very clear affect. It has the same feeling pretty much all the way through. But then you look at it closely, and it's just this kaleidoscope of all sorts of stuff. And you know what's amazing to me about the Beatles is that all that stuff is in there, but the level of craft is so high that none of it comes across as overly contrived or gimmicky. You know, everything is still serves a function and in this fairly concise song form. And yet when you list it all out, it takes pages and pages.
You know, as we get to Sergeant Pepper, if you look in your book, you have these nice tables that list a lot of the topics and the different types. So you spend a lot of time on Sergeant Pepper, as you should, of course. But you know, I'm looking on, this is your table 3.2 on page 171. There are 6 topics that you've got here listed. Classical music. And these, so the heading is main types of topic appearing on Sgt. Pepper, styles and genres. So you've got classical music, Indian music, R&B sometimes overlaps with jazz, country music and the rural, which is an interesting one, ragtime, also interesting, and then earlier 60s rock styles. And and then you list out all the different songs where they appear. So for example, you were talking about waltz time earlier, so you're a LSD one, which of course we know John Lennon said that really was never about LSD. Not at all.
That's a coincidence.
Yeah. But you know that, yes, when you listen to Lucy in the Sky, it has that waltz feel. And as would probably Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite has that too in there. And
And I mean, you know, if I could sort of throw in, one thing that's really interesting about that is that, you know, as you mentioned the waltz earlier, you know, within topics, they tend to get more and more layered. So, I mean, you can say, okay, there's a waltz topic that people understand what you mean if you say that is coherent. Mm-hmm. But then you can say which one, because there's Viennese waltz. There's a kind of more of a, I mean, Lucy
circus waltz.
And that's Mr. Kite, right?
Yeah.
You know, so in that case, you know, those are two very clear. And then if you were to ask, okay, well, what about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds? that's no particular kind of waltz.
No, just kind of a
I mean,
dreamy kind of three,
it's maybe more like the Platonic idea of waltziness or something.
yeah.
And you notice that when it's contrasted on the same album with something as literal as this very circus waltz of Mr. Kite. So like, okay, well, little details like that. Or, just sort of all over that record.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what if you're reading this, what would you want somebody reading this to kind of to see? Oh, well, this is great. This is interesting. He's kind of laid all the catalogs, a taxonomy here, kind of put it all together. But there's more to it than that, I think, right?
As you know, I kind of start out the whole analysis of the album with an apology to the reader. which is writing about music is really hard.
Yes, it is.
Analyzing music is really hard because, you do the analysis and there's all sorts of things that you want to point out because you think people might find it interesting. And then yet you hope that in the long run that might affect the way they listen. Not to be didactic, I don't want to like tell somebody how to hear it. It's more just kind of like, I sort of see this as reporting on what I found.
Yeah.
Like what I kind of would hope is that even though it can be really technical and it can be sort of a slog to read the whole thing and get through it, what you got at the end is I spent a lot of time listening to this and I found all this stuff that I thought was interesting and worth reporting on. So it's sort of like people talking about music. So the analysis is an example of this is a way to hear it, and you might find this interesting and you might hear some of these things too. It's also an example of how to listen in this way. I mean, if you know what a topic is, and then, the book sort of talks about how do you go looking for them. This is a very detailed example of how deep can you dig into a particular album or particular song to find the topics. So I guess what I'm saying is what I would hope is that what people can get out of it is something like a conversation, even though the book form makes it really artificial. It asks the reader to do a fair bit of work to understand what it is I'm trying to say, but the intention is a report on, I heard this, all this stuff, and I thought it was really interesting, so I wanted you
Yeah.
to know about it. Yeah.
Well, that really comes through, I think. So if you get the book and you follow, you can just pick any of the Sgt. Pepper songs, and then you have each song has a nice table where you have the form listed, so verse A, verse B, chorus, the usual stuff, then the actual topics. So for example, on Lucy, I'm looking at, since we're talking about that, you've got the tambura, the doo 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 doo, that stuff that comes in, and that appear, you've got the time of where it is, so 18 seconds to 33 seconds. So I think this works really well as a listener guide. And what you, at least when I was listening to it and reading, following along, you see the multivariant, I guess would be the word, just how it's constantly kaleidoscopic. There's just the surface. It's not just a pop song, and that's what I think this is so valuable for, this approach. It's not just, oh, just a rock song. I mean, you're hearing all these different
Well,
things.
and I think the time codes are important because, I mean, I did that because musical notation is a problem, right? Because if you write it out in staff notation, that alienates a lot of people who don't read that.
Yep.
But if you're listening to this in any kind of digital format, on a CD or on a file on your device, it's usually pretty simple to have a time code running so you know where you are, minutes and seconds. Because, in my mind, a lot of the purpose of musical, there's obviously a lot of transcription in the book too.
Yeah.
And to me, the purpose of that is mostly just to let people know where in the music I'm talking about. If I say there's a waltz and then the waltz turns into, I say, for example, I said with Strawberry Fields, the strings start out kind of classical or horror soundtrack and then they become more Indian. It's good to tell the listener where did that happen, right? So they can hear, if I heard this, they can go to the same spot and see if they hear it the same way, see if they hear something else. So I like the time code for that because it's very accessible. People can just queue up their file, and there's always the danger though that the trimming on their file is slightly different from mine. It's
That's
a little bit, a
true.
few seconds off, but it's close enough, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Definitely. Well, what do you think is the most psychedelic song on Sgt. Pepper? Which one really checks all the boxes more than any other, or is there, or are they all just so different? I mean, you make a good point though, because Paul McCartney said, "Oh, I came up with this idea sitting on the plane, and we're gonna have this
yeah.
band, and it's not really us, and we're just gonna do this band." And then John Lennon, they just do all this stuff, and then John Lennon said, "Oh, the whole thing doesn't hold together at all. We just said it did. It was just a big joke. We didn't mean it." But you make the argument that it actually coheres pretty well as an album, and because of
right.
its topical coherence. So does any
yeah.
one song stand out to you in terms of your...
Well, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, obviously. Although, in a way, I mean, I'll sort of bring my own personal taste into this too. I mean, for me, the stuff that's most psychedelic in some ways is the stuff that's most surprisingly psychedelic. You know, like in other words, where you aren't necessarily expecting it.
Not the obvious things like Lucy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is maybe the most psychedelic song on the record in terms of, if you line up all the... because by the time the Beatles did this, psychedelic style kind of was starting to exist in a codified form, right? There'd been a year and a half, 2 years of psychedelic pop.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you looked at some of the things that were expected from a psychedelic song at this time, Lucy is the one which ticks most of those boxes, right? And lyrically, obviously, too, right? That being said, Within You, Without You, for me.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I find, you know, another thing, if to me, one of the most interestingly psychedelic songs in the Beatles catalog to get on Sgt. Pepper is Blue Jay Way.
Sure, yeah, you Magical
know?
Mystery
in
Tour.
In general,
yeah.
I find George Harrison's take on the psychedelia, not just because, you know, he uses the most obvious Indian components, but something else that I've never been able to put my finger on about his songwriting and his perspective. You know, there's just something very chill.
Yeah, there is.
And very
yeah.
meditative, you know, for obvious reasons, very meditative.
Yeah.
So for me, when I'm listening to it, you know, in terms of when I feel like I'm experiencing something that is psychedelic without being told it's psychedelic.
Aha, that's the difference.
You
yeah.
know, I mean, one thing about the Beatles are great and I love them, but sometimes they can feel a little bit obvious to me, like they're telling what you're supposed to think.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
this is this and that is that. That was a characteristic of the early pop music. It works great as a pop thing because you want pop music is about telling people what it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have to do it well and inventively, but it has to be very upfront. And, you know, into their psychedelic period, it was sort of like that, too. I mean, some of songs like Lucy were like, and also Tomorrow Never Knows.
Oh, yeah.
They're saying you're being psychedelic now. but there's other stuff that creeps up on you, right? So Within You, Without You. For me, also Good Morning, Good Morning.
That's an interesting one, yeah.
And the reason I say that is because one thing I think that's good about Sgt. Pepper, good is an understatement, really great about Sgt. Pepper, is it's psychedelic in a lot of different ways, right? So if you were asking, okay, which ones are most psychedelic in terms of the way they mobilize nostalgia and kitsch even,
mm-hmm.
but then try and give it this new otherworldly kind of quality, well, McCartney was kind of on that, right?
Yeah, When I'm 64 is the obvious...
Yeah,
one there.
So a number of his songs, and also just Sgt. Pepper.
Oh, right? Sgt. Pepper, yeah, sure.
So a lot of his contributions nail that aspect of how to be psychedelic.
Mm-hmm.
George Harrison, obviously, the whole Indian spirituality aspect of it, he tends to contribute the best examples of that, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Lennon is more kind of all over the place, right? So, I mean, Lucy in the Sky is, insofar as it's more his thing, that doesn't have any of his kind of biting darkness
no.
so much. But Good Morning, Good Morning is, you know, one thing that became a big thing I noticed about psychedelic rock in the 60s. By the 70s and 80s, when people thought about psychedelic rock, they tended to think about the peace and love and flower power side of it, the more positive, meditative, happy spirituality.
San Francisco and all the good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Love, right?
Love. Mm-hmm.
But an awful lot of psychedelic rock was dark and scary. It was about psychosis. It was about, because I mean, you know, psychedelics are dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, there was an awful lot of dark stuff and damage that occurred. And,
well, look at Syd Barrett, for example, to take one
yeah,
obvious example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you look at a lot of the earlier sort of garage psychedelia, a lot of that stuff was much more dark and scary, and even like maybe Pink Floyd is an example of a more mainstream band who, you look at Piper at the Gates of Dawn, a lot of that stuff is nightmare stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So one thing I like about Good Morning, Good Morning is that that's not a nightmare song, but it is a chaos song.
Yes. Yeah, you know? And the whole production,
and so to me,
everything.
That's very psychedelic, because that's kind of like, that's right on the edge of losing it kind of music. You know, and so to me, again, that's an important song on Sgt. Pepper, because that gives it a bit more breadth. It isn't all just nostalgic, almost twee, or peace and love, drifty, floaty. It's also got some of this, that sort of biting stuff to it.
Yeah.
So to me, I would say also Good Morning, Good Morning is a really key one for ways to be psychedelic.
That's really interesting. Do you think A Day in the Life, I mean, because that's blowing his mind out in a car, and
yeah, that one is, you know,
some darkness too.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, as you know, when I write in the book, I make a big deal out of how that came after the Sgt. Pepper's reprise.
Right, right.
The way the album was sequenced. And so that one has a strong feeling for me of being something else. The album is over, and now we're going somewhere else. Personally, I've never heard that as particularly psychedelic. And that's a weird thing to say, because it's got so many psychedelic style components.
Yeah, the freak out orchestral.
Yeah, the freak out
crescendo,
orchestral. And
yeah,
then all sorts of things. That,
yeah.
And just the simple structure, where it's this kind of unpredictable, where are we going next kind of structure.
Yeah.
That being said, there's something about the lyrics and the mood of it and the way in which it's formally set off from the whole rest of the record. You know, I've always heard that more as almost kind of a, you know, pointing towards the 70s, pointing towards space rock and prog rock, even effectively. So, you know, I mean, that was interesting too, because you could totally make the case for the other thing and say, no, it's obviously very psychedelic. But to me, that one almost is like a what comes next. And that's why it's probably significant. It's got that ending with that huge long tail off on that chord, right?
Yep.
It's almost like, where are we going now? You know, so there is a kind of a darkness or uncertainty to it, which is very Lennon-esque to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not so much psychedelic. It's almost more like, okay, we've been here now. Where do we go after this? That's my feeling about it.
Yeah. That's really an interesting reading of that, because it's always seen as such a monumental ending kind of song, because it's the big climax of the album, and that's it. But in a way, that long held chord sort of portends something else, like it's not over yet, there's something else, more is to come.
Because I mean, you know, it was an ending for the album, but it was obvious that Sgt. Pepper's band was the Beatles, and the Beatles had broken up, and so there was this, okay, where are we going now, what are we going to do now? That's how I've always felt about it.
Yeah. Well, fascinating. Well, you'll have to read the rest of the book to get the full takes on all the all the songs here. But that's a good taste of what William talks about here. A couple more questions, and we'll wrap it up. We mentioned Pink Floyd. I'm a huge fan of. I like Floyd from pretty much Dark Side before. I'm not a big fan of post Dark Side stuff. So I love the early period, and you were talking about Cathedral things. I'm thinking of Saucerful of Secrets, or one of those huge kind of sounds. But some, and then the Grateful Dead is another huge, big. I'm a big fan of them as well. So, how does your approach study? Is it kind of the same approach to their music, or that you do the Beatles, or is everyone different, even though they're all recording kind of at the same time?
Right. Well, I mean, the approach in terms of how the analytic approach is the same. But the thing is, you know, my approach is like, you know, like when you asked me way back at the beginning, how do you define psychedelic? And I said, well, I like to start with what people have actually said and experienced, reports, you know, so fan reports where they exist, histories, things, journalists, right? You look at what the music meant to people, and then you try and explain why it had those meanings, right? So, you know, that approach. And then because this is about topic theory, I got a specific interest in, when you get to like, why did it mean this? Then you bring in all these mechanisms of the kinds of analysis that work with topic theory to help to explain the specifics. So that method is the same, but you know, because all of these artists are so different, you find very different things. Like the one thing I like about this method is some kinds of analysis, you get the analysis that analysis, it always produces the same kind of result.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, it's baked into the method that it's going to produce a certain kind of result. And that's totally valid for certain kinds of questions, right? But one thing I like about topic theory is it doesn't tend to do that. It tends to, like, you follow the same kind of method for analyzing topics, but you can end up with something that's very different. So the sorts of things I say about Pink Floyd are quite different from what I say about the Beatles. With the Grateful Dead, I got into this long thing about improvisation for really obvious reasons, right?
Yeah, we talk about Dark Star, you know, for example. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and what does it mean to improvise with topics? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Grateful Dead, that discussion becomes, I didn't talk about it with anybody else, right? Pink Floyd is an interesting case to me because, you know, coming back to the being brutal with your page count, there's all sorts of genres that really grow out of psychedelia, and you have to decide where do you cut off. Right? So, I mean, space rock is one of those. You know, if you look at the earliest kind of stuff you might call space rock, most of it was happening within psychedelic rock.
Mm-hmm.
And not just rock, but space pop. So, I mean, Parliament Funkadelic.
Yeah, because so, you've got a whole bunch of interesting stuff on soul music, too.
And that was something that was really important to me was, you know, there's a tendency to talk about psychedelic rock. But one thing, you know, psychedelic Sly and the Family Stone, Parliament Funkadelic, Chambers Brothers, people like this were just as important and central to forming psychedelia, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the space topic, for example, it starts out as part of psychedelia in rock music, but also in soul and funk, also in folk music. But then at some point, it splits off. And so you get this sort of Afrofuturist funk with Parliament. You get space rock with Pink Floyd and later Hawkwind. You could read all that stuff still as psychedelic topicality, and it would be really good to do that, but when you have to, like, keep the book short, you cut it off at a certain point, right?
Yeah.
So with Pink Floyd, there is a real... Obviously, I talk about Piper and the Gates of Dawn and the Syd Barrett era in a fair bit of detail, and then I stop. I think I talk a little bit about Set the Controls for the Heart of the
mm-hmm.
Sun.
That's,
so there's a little bit of post-Barrett, sort of transitional. Nothing about Dark Side of the Moon. Because, you know, what I felt was that you hit a point where it becomes more space rock than psychedelic.
Okay, so it just changes topic, changes genre of style at that point.
Yeah. Not altogether. It's a question of the center of balance, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, even in the, when I was a huge Pink Floyd fan in high school, and it used to drive me nuts because people would always say, oh, you have to be stoned to listen to that. You know, and I was not interested in drugs or involved in drugs. You know, I was into it on a musical level.
Yeah.
But, you know, the point is the music still had that association. So it wasn't like psychedelia wasn't part of it. It's just that it's a question of balance. I felt that by the time you get after Saucerful of Secrets, and even most of that, you don't need to talk about, if you want to talk about the psychedelic topics.
Right.
Because what happens is after that, some of the same psychedelic topics keep coming up, but they get reinflected and combined with more and more stuff, which is not as narrowly psychedelic. And then you have, you know, so it was tricky, but I was never totally happy. It was always a bad compromise. Like, I really wish I could have at least gone through Dark Side with Pink Floyd, for example.
Well, you've always got another article to write or another book. Or.
I know, but it's, you also want to move on, too.
Yeah, right? I know.
Yeah, you don't want to abandon it, but you also don't want to live with it for the rest of your life either.
No, definitely. Well, yeah. to kind of wrap things up, I've a criticism I think that gets attached to a lot of this music is that now it doesn't hold up very well, or it's very dated sounding because of a lot of the topics and a lot of the effects. Like, oh, this, as soon as you hear the Mellotron, it just, okay, God, it's 1967, or it just kind of dates the music. And how do you think the Beatles' psychedelic music holds up? Obviously, it's still very popular, and the Beatles are still extremely popular, and we're doing a podcast on them. But how do you feel like their music compared to some of the other music holds up today?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I guess you could do a whole podcast about what it means to hold up.
Well, right? That's, I mean, like, true. That, yeah. Let's say, you know, I mean, it doesn't have the datedness of some other groups.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first thing you have to say is the Beatles obviously are still relevant to a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
Right? So they're getting something out of it. So, you know, if you want to play devil's advocate and say it's not holding up, I guess you would want to say that what people are getting out of it is just empty nostalgia, and it's actually, you know, it's become trivial. I don't think so. I mean, I think that one thing that happens with some music is that it becomes specific to its time and place, but that doesn't have to dominate how you hear it. You know, it's also possible to hear other things in it. I mean, to me, it's when I hear the Beatles now, I obviously, you know, I hear the 60s, among other things, and early 70s in some cases. But, you know, when I hear Bach, I hear the 18th century. But that doesn't mean that it's dated. It just, it could, I guess what I'm saying is I think music can be associated with a particular time and place without that having to drag it down into triviality. Well, that becomes another part of its meaning, but not the only thing that it means. And I think that the Beatles definitely, for a lot of people, they still get other things out of it. You know, it still touches them or interests them or teaches them things other than just, here's what the 60s or the 70s sounded like.
I think in a way, maybe the approach using topic theory is it kind of makes the music more ecumenical in some way, that because you're talking about its characteristics, not necessarily its...
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, and that's the thing, too. I mean, like, you know, you think about a topic like psychedelia. A lot of things about that cultural movement don't work nowadays,
right,
in my opinion.
Right.
I mean, you know, some people continue to be psychedelic, and that's fine.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for me. But, you know, the thing, because topics are, a topic connects to such a broad range of ideas and meanings and cultural things, you know, topicality was also, psychedelia was also about spirituality. It was also formal experimentation. It was about open-mindedness, right? And so when you hear like really effective 1960s or 70s psychedelic music, you hear an example of the more narrow thing. You know, it's like, oh, this is a ragga rock. That does sound kind of twee at this point. But you also hear people who are experimenting formally, who are trying to be open-minded, who were trying to make a spiritual connection to what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, to the extent that the music can connect to those bigger ideas that are still relevant to people, it gives you a way to reinterpret it and to re-experience it and to make it mean, you know, because the topics continue historically.
Right.
And because the a lot of the topics that were important to the 60s psychedelic people still exist, they've changed. So, you know, spirituality now isn't the same for people as it was in the 60s, but it still is there. And so music which was attempting to be spiritual can still be important to people. You know, and that's why I think the history in a good way can be, it becomes part of that story. You know, you can think, oh, well, I'm hearing stuff which I recognize is coming from a different place and a different time. And so you can think about, well, what's changed? What's different? What's the same? What are the connections? Where are the places we've maybe, you know?
Yeah.
And I think really some music just is really effective at leading people to have those kinds of experiences and ideas. And the Beatles would be on the list for sure, you know?
Definitely. And even today with Paul McCartney's newest album that he recorded this year that we just reviewed, there's Mellotron, it brings back, it's still those same sounds and still the aesthetic is still there, but he's very different now. And it's
exactly.
Yeah. But it's,
you know, and I mean, you know, there's modern, I mean, you can, the Mellotron is still, you know, if you buy a typical keyboard workstation, you're going to get Mellotron sounds. If you go online and you can download virtual Mellotrons, I mean, people still use those sounds even in modern music now.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's, to the extent that most of the stylistic stuff the Beatles did is still current, and it's not just current as nostalgia. Like some people, oh, you got to be honest, sometimes it is nostalgia. There's trivial ways to engage with it too.
Sure.
But there's plenty of people who engage with it in ways that are something other than just nostalgia, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So this has been fascinating conversation, and I hope everyone will go take a look at William's book, Psychedelic Popular Music, and think about these issues as next time you're listening to Sergeant Pepper or any of those incense and peppermint or whatever you...
whatever it is.
I think this gives you a really different way of hearing the music and thinking about it, and kind of paying more attention as a listener, even to all the different things that are happening. So, So thank you so much again, William Eckhard, for speaking with me, and appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
Great. You're welcome. And we'll be back with Chris on our next episode. So until then, we'll see you soon.